The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds of Change. This is Father Tom Coyes. It's a Wednesday, so you know what that means. It's a brain-wrinkling Wednesday, and I guarantee you, I think I'll wrinkle your brain today. Not just me. I have a wonderful guest here with me, and it's going to be a quick, fast hour, but we'll see what we can share with you. I think you've heard me refer to this gentleman. I met him a long time ago, and have been in on and off friends over the years. And I was recently in that precious little state called Texas not long ago, where we were able to reconnect and have lunch. And I said, Daniel, you have to come to Chicago someday to share your story and wrinkle the brains of my people. You need to have your brain wrinkled in order to take the next step higher in that ever-challenging journey of sanctity, right? We all want to, we all should want to be saintly, close to God, and someone who's known for their love and faith of God. So Daniel is one of those fellas in my book, and so I'm gonna ask him to introduce himself a little bit, I'll just shoot some questions at him, but I want him to be able to tell some of his story. And we're in the season of Lent, season of conversion, and the idea of our conversions, our personal conversions, the conversion that the country needs to go through, the conversion this church needs to go through, our parishes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Daniel, why don't you say hello to the many, many listeners of The Winds of Change.
Howdy from Texas. This is Daniel, and I'm glad to be with you. I'll be here with Father Tom Coyes at St. James of Sag Bridge for the next 4 days. So looking forward to spending some time with you this hour, and I hope some of you can come out to the church the next 4 days as we continue to share our story. I believe that conversation leads to conversion. And I believe that it is all about the stories that we all have that we tell. So looking forward to spending this hour with you.
Indeed. We do have our English mission out here in the beautiful southwest corner of the Chicago area, St. James at Sag Bridge. We're at just about 107th and Archer Avenue. Tonight is Wednesday. So tonight, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday nights, where we start at 7 p.m. And on Saturday morning, Daniel will be with us before he's got to check out to that, go back south to the beautiful state of Texas. So Saturday morning, Mass is at 8 o'clock and with a talk afterwards with confessions right after Mass. The theme of the retreat is, or the mission is, conversion changes hearts, converts change history. And one of the things that is very precious about, can I still call you Pastor Precious, Daniel?
Sure.
I have to explain that when we were first met. We first met praying the rosary outside a clinic, right? Abortion clinic. You got to tell our listeners a little bit about that story from what you remember. I'll share. But you could probably tell from his little accent that he's not from Chicago. And so he was a Baptist minister at the time. And so he used the word precious a lot. Now, we don't use that word in Chicago so much. I do now more. Anyways, Daniel, you got the nickname Pastor Precious. So every now and then I might call you Pastor Precious. We were out praying the rosary. This was in the days before, those of you who are involved in the Right to Life movement, before what's known as the bubble zone. I think that came under Bill Clinton, if I'm not mistaken. And the bubble zone really limited a lot of the more forceful, active protests going on at abortion clinics. People would actually chain themselves to a door or circle around people and what have you. So the bubble zone came in, and a lot of the protesting died down. Well, they're still there, and we still pray for those people. So they march in. 40 Days for Life is ongoing again, if you know that. Anybody on the southwest side, you can join. Our little parish takes the 3 p.m., the beautiful Divine Mercy Hour, 3 p.m. on Fridays, at an abortion clinic on 75th Street, just east of I-355. So if you're in the neighborhood, come on out for that. Daniel, you just mentioned this morning that it was 28 years ago, I think.
28 years ago, Holy Week here in Chicago. That's exactly right. At the time, I was a board member of Operation Rescue National, and I had found myself praying the rosary in front of Loyola University by myself because I don't like to carry signs and do the little walk around with signs. So I went to a little place to pray the rosary by myself. And when I opened my eyes, there were 18 Catholics standing by me all saying the rosary. And the people with signs were walking all around us while ABC News was recording us on the radio. And the leaders of Operation Rescue didn't like that too much. So they abandoned me at Midway Airport on the night of the beginning of Tritium. And also when...
What does it mean to be abandoned at the airport, you mean?
Well, they all went home and left me at the airport without a ticket. So I was abandoned in Chicago. And the only priest that I'd met was Father Tom. And so I called and said, hey, can you come pick me up? It was also the first time that he was singing The Exultant. So that night I got to hear him perform The Exultant, not perform, but sing the beautiful Exultant during the beautiful beginning of Tritium.
Indeed, I forgot about that. That Tritium, the Exultant at the beginning of the Easter Vigil. It's always one of my favorites. I don't know if I did it that day, but I got to confess, I used to have it memorized. I used to have it memorized. I just love that thing so much. And but they changed some of the words, and they changed the melody in the new Roman Missal. And I'm thinking, oh, darn, I don't have this one memorized. And so I have done the old one, even though the new one is in the books now, but it's almost the same. The old one is, there's so often, you know, some people in liturgy sometimes feel like they just got to keep changing things in order to feel that they're doing something important. And I don't know that that's that important. I've talked about the change of the act of contrition, actually, and maybe we'll get into that if we so desire. And okay, so yeah, you were abandoned by Operation Rescue. Can you remind the people a little bit about, wasn't Randall Terry, he's one of the president or so?
Randall Terry began Operation Rescue, but at that time, the leader was Flip Benham. So anyway, he decided to leave me at the airport, and I was stuck in Chicago for a couple of days until I was going to get to Cincinnati for Human Life International. I don't know if any of you go that far back with Father Paul Marks and beautiful Human Life International. And that was another reason they were a little miffed, because the Catholics had invited me to come and play, and they had not gotten to be invited.
You know, let me clarify that. They were primarily, they knew you from your ministry down in Texas, of course, and I think Randall Terry or Flip were from the Midwest somewhere, or Randall might have been from Texas. Anyways, I wanted to be clear that they were upset because you were hanging around some Catholics?
Well, they were upset because as a Baptist pastor, I prayed the rosary. I'm a big fan of the rosary, and it goes back for many, many years. I used to battle Planned Parenthood in Waco, Texas, and we actually battled Planned Parenthood International because the International Board Chairman was living in Waco, Texas at the time. So I discovered quite easily that if you wanted to get people in front of Planned Parenthood for any length of time, the Baptist, after 5-6 minutes of prayer, would turn to talking about the Dallas Cowboys. But if you pulled out the rosary, you could get a good 45 minutes of prayer out of people. So I was the first to organize, as a Baptist pastor in Waco, Texas, the rosary hour in front of Planned Parenthood, and actually started the rosary hour in front of St. Mary's, the Catholic Church, on Mother's Day. So I was just kind of known as the Baptist pastor who prayed the rosary.
I have to confess, too, that when you introduced yourself and we were praying the rosary like we so often do, the idea of Moses encountering the burning bush came to my mind. Remember that story in the Old Testament? Moses is wandering around in the wilderness, and he sees a bush on fire, but it was not being consumed. And so he said to himself, there's a bush that's on fire and it's not being consumed. I better go take a better look. This is a very strange sight. So when you introduce yourself, oh, I'm Baptist minister from Texas and we're here to pray, I'll go, this is a very strange sight. I better go take a closer look. So from that point on, we did become friends, and there is a kind of friendship. Maybe we could pause for a moment on this, my friends. Those of you who maybe are more active in the right to life, or those who are not, you know, but are pro-life in your heart, there is a friendship that develops around people in that movement. It's not because all the people in the movement are pure as the wind-driven snow. And it's not because, we look down at people with self-righteous indignation. I find it quite the contrary. Most of the people that are out at those clinics praying are people that feel the woundedness, or feel the anxiety, feel the dilemma that the person is facing, and just want them to not make that decision that carries with it too many regrets and what have you. So obviously there can be, there's a line, like everything, I'm just going to say this, there's a line with everything, you step over that you become a bit obnoxious. Or you can become, there's an old song by Paul Simon that saying one trick pony, you know, and the one trick pony is a reference to, I guess, you know, a carnival act, and this one, your pony that you bring to the carnival act only knows how to do one trick, and you hope he does it very well. But it's not necessarily a good thing. It's not necessarily a good thing, especially in the context of what I've said a number of times on this platform, G.K. Chesterton's sense of the unity of all the causes that are Catholic / Christian. There is a unity. You can't embrace them all. There's so many, but you shouldn't embrace just one at the exclusion or some kind of the deference or the putting down of the other. Does that make any sense to you, Danny? Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. It is important. And again, that brings me back to the rosary because it's a common bond. As you begin to pray the beautiful stories of the life of Jesus. In fact, I like to explain the rosary to people who have never done it as a saying that it's the stories of Jesus as told through the eyes of Mary, his mother. When you think of it, that's what our rosary is. It's the stories of Jesus, the different aspects of his life, as seen through the eyes of Mary, the mother of God, and our mother.
That's precious. Truly, it is. And for those of you who are Chosen fans, you get a little of that in the Chosen, more so the eyes of the disciples through that new TV show / movie. And I'm glad in that presentation of the gospel, Mary is, she's not too focal, which she probably wasn't in the ministry of Jesus, his public ministry, but she's, you know what I'll say for those who have seen that episode, those episodes and like them, she speaks with her silence a lot. And I'm glad they don't give her a lot of lines, but you could tell in her facial expressions, she's with Jesus on a different level than the apostles, which is kind of right in terms of we pick up a lot of the ideas and understandings of the Blessed Mother, not so much through the Bible, but through many of her apparitions and many of the writings of other saints that have really had encounters with Blessed Mother. Anyways, we're past the quarter hour here. Daniel, let's take the first break, okay, and we'll come right back. I'm Father Tom Coyes. We're on the Winds of Change on AM 750.
You can help save a life by praying for an end to abortion in your community. Find a 40 Days for Life vigil nearby. Visit 40daysforlife.com, 40daysforlife.com, to help save a life.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
I'd like to suggest the most important thing you can partake of this Lent. I'm referring to that which contains the whole spiritual good of the Church. Yes, your entire spiritual good. Listen to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, 1324. The Eucharist is the source and summit of the Christian life. The other sacraments, and indeed all ecclesiastical ministries and works of the apostolate, are bound up with the Eucharist and are oriented toward it. For in the Blessed Eucharist is contained the whole spiritual good of the Church, namely Christ Himself, our Pasch. End quote. Jesus Himself longingly awaits you daily in Holy Mass and in the Monstrance or Tabernacle. I'm Jim Littleton, formingfaithfulfamilies.com.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyes here. Thanks for listening to The Winds of Change. I'm with an old friend of mine and a guy who's going to be giving our Lenten mission here at St. James, way in the southwest corner of the Chicago area, St. James of the Sag in Lamont. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, each night at 7 p.m. Saturday, we have Mass at 8 a.m. and a talk afterwards. And so if I can split this little interview up, Daniel, between your conversion and some a friend of yours who many of us know, and I met Norman McCorvey on a couple of times, but post conversion, I must say. So she certainly has a very interesting story, and it's contained in a book called The Family Row. Now, I don't know if you remember a few months ago when in one of our phone conversations, you said, have you read the book, The Family Row? I said, no, but I suppose it has something to do with Jane Roe of Roe versus Wade. You said, well, yes, it does. And I knew, of course, that was the pseudonym or the nickname for Norman McCorvey. And so I sometimes do, I order the audiobook. And so I'm going to play a snippet from, it's a book written by Prager. What's this?
Josh.
Josh? Joshua Prager. Tell us a little bit before I play. Who's the author?
Joshua Prager wrote the bestseller, The Family Row, and it was actually not, it was during part of the lockdown, so it came out in 2021. And I strongly recommend it, even though I may disagree with him on a couple of points when it comes to Norma, but I strongly recommend the book because he has done the best job of showing what the abortion issue in America is all about. And he really puts it together with sex and God.
Yeah, it's a gripping read or listen. And I was fascinated by the three daughters. Norma had three daughters that they spilled a lot of ink in that aspect of it, and also I don't know how else to say it, but how messed up her life was in and out of relationships. And anyways, okay, but before we get to Norma, I let me play this because it starts with your conversion. You had a conversion when you were a little boy, earlier in the book, but I'm not on this clip I'm going to share, but it does say that you had read the Bible several times by the time you were 9 years old. Now, that's a good start. That's a good start. Okay, but here's a little segment from The Family Row. It goes like this.
But Vinzant had a secret. Though he was Baptist by birth and had gone to Baptist College and Baptist University and Baptist Seminary, he increasingly wished to be Catholic. Even as Vinzant ministered to his own evangelical flock, he went to Mass every week of his pastorship, stealing away on Sunday mornings to a church across town where he sat out of view in the choir loft.
So that's an interesting bit. And of course, me as a Catholic priest makes me want to appreciate the Mass that I'm ordained to offer. I have to confess, you have to keep studying it, you have to keep appreciating it, or else it gets mundane. It can easily become so familiar, familiarity can breed contempt. But in that little passage from the book, The Family Row, it mentions how you would go attend a Catholic Mass. What was it about that time in your life, and what was it about Catholicism that was tugging at your shoulder, your heart?
I'll talk more in the talks, but just to give you a quick snippet. You were right. I was given my first King James Bible when I was six, and by the time I was nine, I'd read through it cover to cover twice. And by the time I was 17, I had created my own system where I would read through the King James Bible every 30 days. So the Bible was very important to me. They bring out in the Vatican Papers, Vatican II, which was, I know it's a consternation to many conservative Catholics, but but it was beautiful papers that brought many evangelicals like me to the church because we saw the church put together on paper and fresh eyes. And one of the things it does there is it says that what is common between evangelicals and Catholics is the martyrs. And the Catholics have martyrs who will die for the Eucharist, like Eutychus, the first century boy, you know, who would die holding the Eucharist in his hand when he was being beaten up by the other children because he was not going to give up that precious body and blood. We, as evangelicals, had those who died for the Word of God, like Jim Elliot with the Aka Indians. And so we have this common martyrdom of the faith. And so when I was 17, I was given a lot of responsibilities in the church. And the first was to run a youth group at First Baptist Church, Woodway, Texas. And I had a couple that the boy was a little older than me. He was 18. The girl was 17. And people began to whisper that they were actually having relations. And I had hubris my first job, you know, wanting to make everyone be stellar Baptist, and brought them into my office and sat them down and said, look, you can't be having sex outside of marriage. We're Baptists. We don't even dance because that's having sex standing up. And the guy was brazen enough to say, I want to be Catholic. And I had enough naivety that I thought, well, I don't even know a single Catholic. I don't even know where the Catholic Church is in town. Never even thought about Catholics, but I thought, let's jump in my car and I'll take you to the local Catholic Church and introduce you to the priest. And if you can be a good Baptist, maybe you'll be a good Catholic. And so I did, and a year later, he invited me to his confirmation. When I walked into the church, I didn't know who the funny guy was in the shepherd's hat. I didn't know who the guy was with the shepherd's staff. I didn't know what the red candle was, but I felt something amazing with the stained glass windows and the candle and the incense and what I later found out was the bishop and the order of confirmation. And
Daniel, I got to stop. Did those two ever get married, or did they appreciate the injunction to live chastity, shall we say?
No, they did not. In fact, they had a terrible end when he showed up one evening and didn't find the front door open and went around to the bedroom and found her with someone else. And he threw his 18-year-old arm through the window and almost committed suicide by slashing his wrist. It was a pretty bad breakup. But he remained faithful to the day he died as a Catholic, did marry a beautiful Catholic woman and had a beautiful Catholic family and lived the faith.
Well, that's precious. I'm sorry, that's the only word that comes to my mind. All these, for us Catholics who didn't know many Baptists, it's interesting that you focused on the point about not dancing or drinking. That's an icon, or that's a stereotype that kind of sticks in our minds. And it's a double-edged sword, because sometimes people will say, well, I want to be a Catholic because I want to drink. I don't want to live such an austere life, as it were. And that's not really the way to enter into Catholicism, because we have some strictness too. As a matter of fact, I often will say that the Catholic Church its strictness comes into play, especially when it comes to marriages, divorces, and remarriages, and artificial contraception. Those two things are key that add a kind of strictness that most Protestant denominations do not have. So in other words, get married whenever you want, whoever you want, and all the rest, and But if it fails, just come again and we'll try again and we'll keep trying again. There is no, in other words, Catholicism is the only religion that has what we call the annulment process, or it's, I'll call it this, the ideal of monogamy for life, as it were. And of course, we all know people that have divorced, and it's a tragedy, but to hold that sacramental nature is a kind of strictness that is different than, well, you can't drink or you shouldn't dance. You can't drink or you shouldn't dance reminds me a bit of the Puritans from England, who took it so far that you couldn't celebrate birthdays. Christmas, celebration of Christmas was forbidden. And I wish I had at my fingertips, but I don't. There's a funny Monty Python skit about Puritans celebrating Christmas. Somebody came to a Puritan's house on, maybe it was Thanksgiving or Christmas, with a big goose that they were welcoming their neighbor. Hey, we just stopped by to wish you welcome into the neighborhood, and we cooked this big goose for Christmas so that you can enjoy. And the Puritan says, well, we don't celebrate. That's terrible. You should never do that. And they take the goose and throw it to the ground. And then one of the ladies in the crowd says, oh my goodness, well, that's terrible. Would you want to come to the Christmas dance? No, you got to be kidding. You can't do that. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'll just be, let me just go and I'll fix my makeup and be on my way. You wear makeup. You can't do that. Anyways, that's the stereotype of the Puritans that unfortunately sometimes us non-Baptists might paint the Baptist genre with. But it's okay if we have some stereotypes, but we have to let them know that they're not people stereotype Catholics in different ways. One big way is, oh, you have a lot of children. If there's a mother with five children, you must be Catholic. That's a stereotype, but I almost don't mind it. I almost feel proud that we're known as people who have big families. So a Baptist might feel put down by not drinking, but there's a heck of a lot of people that need to learn the lesson of the evils of alcohol and how many people we know that are struggling with alcoholism. And there's a lot of wisdom to some of that. So it reminds me of, let me throw this and then we'll take a next little break and we'll come back. But Chesterton says that when you think of the different religions, many people say, oh, deep down they're all the same. And but on the surface, they all look different, you know. But he says, if you think about it, it's the opposite is true. On the surface, they all look the same in the sense that all different religions have a priesthood, have ritual, have some kind of organization. Whether we have, of course, a strong hierarchy in Catholicism, and it's a mixed sword, depending on what leaders you have, right? We can't get around that. But when people would criticize Catholicism for having a hierarchy, I like to say, you know, you can't get away from a hierarchy. There's a hierarchy in any kind of organization you could come up with. Sports, theater, politics. There's always some kind of hierarchy. But anyways, so Chesterton says that it's deep down that the different religions are different. They have a kind of similarity on the external or on the surface, what you see. But if you study doctrines, you'll soon uncover great and sometimes, of course, vast different teachings about God, about human nature and what have you. Okay, let's take our, it's the bottom of the hour, so let's take our next break and we'll be back. I'm sitting with Daniel Vinzant, our speaker at our Lenten mission here at St. James. I'm Father Tom Coyes on the Winds of Change on AM 750.
For 150 years, St. Stanislaus Koska Academy has been an oasis that builds a moral foundation for your child based upon Catholic faith, virtue, and valor, along with strong academic preparation for children pre-kindergarten through eighth grade. Here's how you can help St. Stanislaus Koska Academy and have a good time. Come out and play for St. Stan's Academy during the annual Casino Night Fundraiser, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Enjoy casino games, food, drinks, and great music, all while helping to support St. Stanislaus Koska Academy, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Now, you must be 21 or over. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is located at 1255 North Noble in Chicago. That's one block north on Noble, off Division, just off the Kennedy.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Koska Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to the Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic, social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back. Father Tom Coyes here. You are listening to the Winds of Change. I'm with an old friend of mine, Daniel Vinzant. And we're talking about conversions, our everyone's need for conversion. But Daniel has an interesting story. He's gone through, I would say, maybe you could say, a few different stages of conversion. One, when you're little, when you're a teenager, when you're a young adult, when you're older, and all the rest. I want you to talk a little bit about that, and then. I want the listeners to hear some of the story of Norman McCorvey, but I have to tell the listeners a couple of things that I recall from my early days, a couple of your visits here in Chicago. I remember one, we were driving through the streets of Chicago. I was down in the south side of Chicago in the barrio, hablando español and doing what I could. Anyways, we drive around. And there's a lot of churches in Chicago. There's a lot of Protestant churches and a lot of Catholic churches. And when we drive by a church, you would quickly ask, is it Catholic or not? And if I said, oh yeah, that's one of ours. That's a Catholic church. You would quickly make the sign of the cross, which is a beautiful tradition because it helps. What you were referring to, of course, is, oh, there's the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. Another thing I recall was standing in the back of our church. We get a lot of stuff in the mail. And one of the things I often did with stuff that comes in the mail was I'd put the free stuff out on a table in the back of church. And I remember you saying, this is great. There's all this free stuff here. We don't put anything in the back of church without a price tag on it. Do you remember that? And there was one more. I don't know if you could say some of the things that started to impress you as you got into the Catholic world. For us Catholics who take a lot of things for granted, I had two priest friends over at the rectory, and I think we had a third guy. So there were four of us at morning mass, and one priest was the main celebrant, and the others, as we say, concelebrate or you know, we just sit and listen to his sermon and what have you, but we stand around the altar. And you said something that stuck with me. You go, that is so nice to see the priests there all together at the Mass. I said, why is that? He said, well, in the Protestant world, a Protestant minister will drive across Texas to give a talk, but won't walk across the street to hear a talk. Do you remember any of those things?
I remember them all. It's all true. It's all true.
Any other little things that started to you know?
Sure. So after that confirmation time at the church, I found myself just really being drawn to the Mass. And I do these talks to bishops from time to time, and they keep going, how could you go to Mass for 18 years and no one say, don't you want to be a part of us? Don't you want to join us? And I said, you know, Bishop, I like to say that the loneliest place in America is any pew in the Catholic Church. I said, I could go for 18 years and no one would say, would you like a donut? Would you like a hymnal? Are you new here? Hi, my name is so-and-so. That's just not part of being Catholic. And as the bishops would put their hand on my knee and bemoan how they need to learn from evangelicals about being a little friendlier in church, I'd go, oh, no, no, no. They're all so intent on adoration.
There are a lot of things we can learn from the evangelical methodology, as it were. I don't want to put a Starbucks in the back of my church at this point, but darn it if I didn't have a strong desire to have donuts and coffee after every Mass. So that's what we have here at St. James. We have donuts and there may be a little virtue in anonymity, in the sense that when I come into church, I don't want to be bothered. there's a two-edged sword there. I know exactly what you mean. There should be friendliness, and sometimes, I hate to use the phrase like this, but some might be too friendly or not take the hint. You know, if somebody does say, hey, are you new here? What's your name? And it's sort of clear that they just want to be left alone, you back off. But that doesn't mean you don't try and you don't introduce yourself. You know, let me say this too, and all of you wonderful people listening. If you're in a church group, whether it's, and you're talking, and there's more than two people in the group, in other words, a little group of three, four, or five people, when you're talking and you're going to address someone else, use their name. That in itself will be, Joe, what did you think of the Bulls or the Bears or the, Mary, weren't you you went to that movie, didn't you? And so if you know the name, of course, we talk with a lot of people, and I'm guilty front and center. I talk to a lot of people. I can't remember their name. And I pray at times, Lord, help me remember somebody's name, especially when they know me, and they assume I know their name, but I don't. I'm trying to fish for their name. I remember early on in the when Cardinal George came to Chicago. Every time I met him, I would say, "Oh, hello, Cardinal George. I'm Father Tom Coyes," and I'm sure he appreciated me saying that for the first number of times, but somewhere along the line, I remember saying, oh, hello, Cardinal George, I'm Father Tom Coyes. And he goes, I know. And so that's what we were talking about, the friendliness at the Mass. Singing, that's another thing. Catholics usually just let the choir sing, or if we sing, we only sing one verse. In Protestant churches, you don't get out without singing all four verses. I'm just going to guarantee you that, which is, I like that in a certain sense, but the in and out part of the problem is we got a lot of Masses, and there's a thing called parking lot, and there's a thing called you got to get moving, et cetera. Anything, does that remind you of anything else?
No, that is that is all true. It is. But yes, it would be nice to do that one thing and just be a little friendlier before and after in the Catholic Church. But I will say this. I was 25 years a Baptist pastor, and now 25 plus years as a Catholic. And when I decided to make the transition to the Church, because I believe that it all revolved around body, blood, soul, and divinity. That was the question, and I needed to be with the people who believed that. That the other thing was, I was so glad to leave the weariness of the cult of personality in the evangelical world. But now, 25 plus years later in the Catholic Church, I'm so concerned about Catholics who are drawn to the cult of personality. Suddenly, we thrust that upon certain priests or bishops, and I'm not sure that's a good thing. I'm not sure it is.
Yeah, because we all have to realize, speaking as a priest, that the Church is bigger than me, and I might be a priest, but I'm not the high priest. That's Jesus Christ. And we all know that we touch some people's hearts in a good way, and we turn other people off. That's one of the beauties of the old Mass. I've been getting into the old Mass somewhat. And when you do the old Mass, your personality is much more hidden, shall we say, even so. We got a little bit of time left, but I'm gonna play this one clip from that book again, The Family Row, by Joshua Prager, who very interestingly has certain issues in his life that I think are behind some of the little bit twisted presentation of some of the facts in that book. I do recommend it too. I found it a great read. But let's do this. After this, we'll go into our final break, okay, Daniel? But this is from The Family Row as well.
Norma knew that another conversion would bring upon her another wave of press, but it was more than the prospect of publicity that drew her to Catholicism. Catholicism spoke to her, for if Norma wished of religion one thing, it was absolution. The assurance that she could be forgiven not only Roe, but all her trespasses, the drink and drugs and sex and relinquishment of children. She was comforted by confession. She got to feel the forgiveness, says Pavone. He adds, Catholicism uses the senses much more than the Protestants.
That's a precious little description when Norma was looking for something more than just the Christianity. She wanted to become Catholic. I want Daniel to talk a little bit about that from his experience. But let's take our final break here. I'm Father Tom Coyes on the Winds of Change on AM 750.
Sometimes it's tough to hear winds of change over the air. What with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air, live, Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststandschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button. For Winds of Change podcasts, click on Listen to Episodes or visit the Winds of Change Facebook page.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
You can help save a life by praying for an end to abortion in your community. Find a 40 Days for Life vigil nearby. Visit 40daysforlife.com, 40daysforlife.com, to help save a life.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm Father Tom Coyes on the Winds of Change. So, Daniel, I just played that little clip from the book, The Family Row, touching on Norma's conversion. She had a series of conversions. She just passed away recently, if I remember correctly. And give our listeners some insights into Norma.
I have to say, in the 660 plus pages of the book, that particular clip, that sentence is my favorite of the whole book, because Josh completely encapsulates the seriousness and the reality of Norma's conversion to the Catholic Church. And it's very interesting. Her first conversion to being a Christian as an evangelical was under such amazing scrutiny. She was on a Ted Koppel, whatever that show was back in the day, and she was interviewed by Peggy Wehmeyer from ABC, and she had a lot of missteps and things that she said. And Josh can bring out that Norma was a bit of a player in the sense that she played to her audience. And so there was a lot of questions, just how sincere was her conversion to Christianity. But Josh makes it so clear that her conversion to the Catholic Church was 180 degrees completely, that it was the most sincere part of her life because it was the only thing that gave her forgiveness from guilt. And I believe that is a powerful part of any convert's testimony in coming to the church, is that these seven sacraments, this liturgy, all the things that we've put together through the 2,000 years gives us a sense of forgiveness from guilt.
Indeed, many, many famous converts had that same reaction, looking for, why did you become Catholic? I wanted to be forgiven. And of course, everybody in the Christian denominations, they all talk about come to Jesus and he will forgive you. But it's the way I often put it is, since Protestant denominations don't have the priest minister saying, I forgive you, a lot of their sermons have to be, turn your life around, you're going to hell, and once you turn your life around, come to Jesus, and we do an altar call, and then God will forgive you. So it's done in a different way, but the Catholic way has that one-on-one, right?
I have to give you an example from one of the early days of legitimate confession after I'd become Catholic and was known as a Catholic. I went to one of these parishes that did have a dark confessional, which is always my favorite. None of this face-to-face stuff for me. But this confessional had 3-inch louvre blinds between the priest and the confessor. And so I'm beginning my confession in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Bless me, Father. And suddenly the louvres come wide open, and the priest goes, wouldn't you like to come over and sit by me? And there's 100 people outside in line, which is a wonderful thing in the South where we do like to show up for confession. And they hear this voice screaming from the dark confessional, no! And then the poor priest meekly, you know, closes the blinds and he goes, I'm sorry. And I said, no! And then I used scripture to explain. I said, you know, I come in the darkness of my sin to the darkness of this confessional so that after I pour out my heart, the priest standing as Jesus Christ, suddenly I hear in his words the face of Jesus Christ and the knowledge of the glory of the love of God comes shining through the darkness. This beautiful light of forgiveness that the church and only the church offers its people in sincerity.
And that's a good, I prefer as the priest to be behind a screen too. For a couple of reasons. One is if there were no sins that were not a little embarrassing to confess, I guess we wouldn't need a screen. But there are a lot of sins that are a little embarrassing to confess. And so by forcing people to do face-to-face, in a certain sense, I feel we're making it all that much harder to confess a sin that might be a little hard to confess. I see as a major problem in many of our Catholic schools, we force them in the sense of not giving the option of a screen. Also, if I'm doing confessions for 2 or 3 hours, I sometimes am getting tired, and sometimes I'm positioning my body in a way that might look like I'm not paying attention, but I am paying attention. My back starts to hurt, so I have to shift this way, or I shift that way. And so I don't want people to at all think I'm not listening, but it helps a little in that regard. Let me say this too. Some people think of confession, this is Catholic or Protestant, they'll think on the one hand, it's too hard. Why would you make somebody say their sins to a human like that? Isn't it much easier to just confess directly to God? And of course, it is much easier in that sense. So on the one hand, some people look at the Catholic sacrament of penance and they say, it's too hard. Why would any church kind of hold on to that? But then the very next moment, they'll say, that sacrament, you mean you can you can sin all you want and the priest is going to forgive you? Isn't that too easy? You know? It obviously can be taken advantage of you. We've all probably been there. I know I'm going to confession on Saturday, so I can do a lot of sinning on Thursday and Friday. And unfortunately, that sneaks into our heart, and that's wrong. And that's a major reason why I think when you read what all the reformers, Martin Luther and all the rest, they hated the fact that people can just confess their sins and not change their heart. And that's something to be upset about, but that pushes us to understand the fullness of perfect contrition versus imperfect contrition. And let's face it, most of the time our contrition is imperfect, and God doesn't require perfect contrition to be forgiven. Praise the Lord for that.
It is one of the most wonderful aspects of our faith. And I will tell you this, I experienced just last Saturday in confession, first of all, 4 priests in a church, 30 people in line, 15 on one side, 15 on the other side, 2 confessionals. There was just a joy seeing us all as we're waiting our turn. And I was reflecting of 2 times in my life during times of great seriousness where priests not only gave me absolution, but cried with me over my sins. But this last young priest, I said, I'm going to stop you right there and begin to laugh over some of my sins. It was
how about that? Well, that music reminds us that our hour is quickly ended. I want to thank Daniel Vincent for being with us here on the Winds of Change. Come out to St. James tonight, tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday morning for our Lenten mission. God bless you. See you next time.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide the wind.